Six birthing and teaching hospitals in Philadelphia just announced they are no longer giving new mothers free formula when they leave the hospital to go home. It's part of a push to encourage more moms to breastfeed their newborns. While nationwide rates of breastfeeding have increased, in Philadelphia they still remain below average, and the same is true for Delaware, according to some recent data. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that babies be breastfed for the first 6 months. Most moms stop around three. So what are the best ways to encourage women to breastfeed their babies? What are the barriers that stop women from nursing, and what kind of supports do they need to continue? And we have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Esther Chung. She's a professor of pediatrics at Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University and Nemours. She's also the medical director of the newborn nursery at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Esther Chung, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Deborah Sandrock. She's an attending physician at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. She's a board-certified lactation consultant, also assistant professor of pediatrics at Drexel University College of Medicine. And Deborah Sandrock, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. And we'll be hooking up with our third guest in just a moment or two. Deborah, let me begin with you and begin with the fact that something like, 75% of at least new moms leave the hospital intending on breastfeeding their children?
That's what we're seeing in Philadelphia. We're having, at St. Christopher's, we see on average of about 170 newborns per month. And when we look at the statistics, about 75% of them come to us with some form of breastfeeding. 25% are exclusive.
Does that surprise? I mean, I have to say, when I read that number, I was happily surprised.
We are, too, because it's really been an adventure over the last several years that I've been working in breastfeeding in Philadelphia, that the hospitals have come together as a group to really try to encourage moms to breastfeed when they're in the hospital, and a little bit prenatally as well. We're really doing some extra special work to get things going.
Do you say it's because of the hospitals trying to make this concerted effort?
I think that by coming together as six hospitals and having regular meetings, there's a little bit of a competitive edge that we see.
Oh, is that right?
What's happening down the street?
We're going to do better than your hospital.
And so I think that's really sort of revved up the energy. But really, people recognize the benefits of breastfeeding, and they want to do what they can to support and help women.
And do women recognize the benefits? I mean, do new moms and perhaps dads as well, do they understand the benefits?
You know, when I'm talking to medical students and residents, I say, I think women get that breast is best. It's really more about role models and friends and the supports that they get. So women want to do it. It's just that I think they don't always know how to do it.
So in a sense, once they get outside the hospital, perhaps they don't feel the support that they might have had in the hospital?
That's right. And the first 2 weeks can be very challenging because it's new for the baby and new for the mother. We find that about 90% of women want to breastfeed when they come into our hospital, and about 60% leave breastfeeding.
Deborah, going back to you, that this idea of, I think it's called ending the bag or bagging the bag or...
Banning the bag.
Banning the bag. I mean, is this part of a national effort, or is this something that's pretty locally based?
No, this is a national effort. It's all part of the United States trying to become a little bit more breastfeeding friendly. And so what we try to do is to get rid of free formula so that when the families leave the hospital, they're not given that, you know, that cue that perhaps maybe I should use this if I'm not doing so well with breastfeeding, or just getting a free bag just to say that, formula is out there and maybe I should be using it.
And how do the formula companies feel about this program?
Has
there been pushback?
I've not heard a lot of pushback personally. I know that the hospitals that I deal with, I work at Hahnemann as well, and they've not really had a big pushback from the formula companies.
How about for you?
I think we learned from our colleagues in Boston, and then there have been publications from Oregon as well, that you know, as scary as it sounds to kind of break a relationship that you've had long-term with some of the formula companies, There's not a lot of backlash that happens when hospitals decide to go away from free formula. And we were a bit nervous when we entered into it at our hospital, but we had conversations with all the companies that we had worked with, and finally we were able to work out a pretty good arrangement. They want to make sure that their formula is still being used by the babies that need it and want it, and so I think they find that the relationship is so important that they don't break ties with you.
And again, that's Esther Chung. She's a professor of pediatrics. And also with us, Deborah Sandrock, an attending physician. And joining us now is Kimberly Seals-Allers. She's a journalist, a breastfeeding advocate. In fact, has been working on an initiative in the Strawberry Mansion neighborhood here in Philadelphia and founder of MochaManual.com. And Kimberly Seals-Allers, nice to have you with us on Radio
Thank
Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. How did you get interested in this as a journalist?
Well, really, you know, I'm a journalist, but I'm a mother. That's my most important job. And so as a mother, when I chose to breastfeed my own children, I began to face barriers, whether it was, you know, having that good experience in the hospital, but going home to a community where I didn't have any support, lack of role models, as was mentioned, lack of multi-generational support, and really began to see some of the real-life barriers going back to work. I mean, we talk about breast is best, which has been great messaging around the benefits, but we haven't really showed women how to do it in the context of their actual lives. So many moms have to return to work. So many employers may not have lactation-friendly policies. And so what I was finding in my own experience was that it wasn't that I didn't want to. As we've heard, the numbers in terms of intent are there, but women are facing real barriers, both structural, in their communities, areas which I call first food deserts, right? Deserts of support to give for mothers to give that essential first food. And so these were some of the things that I faced. I began to write about it as a journalist and then realized that I was not alone and really became an unintended spokesperson for women who were, you know, facing some of the same challenges that I was facing. And so really not wanting others to have those barriers and face those obstacles has really been my motivation to do more and try to improve conditions so that every mother who chooses to can breastfeed.
And that is why you are here, Kimberly Seals-Allers, because of that kind of work. And it's interesting, she works in the Strawberry Mansion section of Philadelphia, which is in a low-income area. Is there a difference? I'm looking at you, Esther Chung. Is there a difference when it comes to poverty, or perhaps more middle-class parents are more likely to breastfeed, but not so much for low-income parents?
Absolutely. I mean, the numbers have shown that over and over again, that low-income, less educated, single mothers who are in minority populations are less likely to breastfeed. And, you know, when you talk to some groups, like if you went out to the suburbs of Philadelphia and some of the wealthier neighborhoods, it would almost be an expectation that women breastfed.
And almost they would a pressure, feel, I think, for
almost
some.
A pressure as well. And some of that is helpful in the sense that if everyone you know breastfeeds, then it seems like you should too. Whereas if nobody around you breastfeeds, it's very hard to have the incentive to do so because of some of the challenges that women face in the first couple of weeks.
You want to speak to that as well? Because I know St. Christopher's is also in a low-income neighborhood in Philadelphia.
Yes, we have a very large population of patients who have low-income issues and very young moms. And so on a day-to-day basis, when we take care of these moms, it's very impressive to see how many want to breastfeed, but they just lack the support systems at home. So we try very, very hard in our institution to provide that support that they may need. We created a milk line so that they can call in and ask questions, and we bring them in as often as they need to. But the moms, you know, they really just struggle so much.
But is it, as Kimberly was describing, I'll get to you, Kimberly, in just a second, that there aren't role models, or perhaps people are sort of question, why are you breastfeeding your baby, things like that?
That's precisely what it is. I mean, there are no role models. They don't have sisters or aunts or cousins or grandparents who have breastfed, so they don't know how to or who to turn to. So, you know, the hope is that with creating these big networks, in at least in the medical world, that we might be able to provide the support that they need, you know, to at least get them somewhat through those first steps so that they continue their journey on breastfeeding.
Kimberly, is there some kind of a taboo related to breastfeeding? Does it say something about how perhaps young moms think about their breasts, their bodies, their sexuality? Help us understand this.
Well, there are several factors. At first, I definitely want to speak to the low-income piece, because I think one of the things that's often forgotten is that, you know, WIC is the largest purchaser of infant formula in this country. And so in low-income communities, you see a high prevalence of people who are WIC eligible, and therefore there is lots of marketing of infant formula. And so it is very hard, particularly when formula is perceived as free, to talk to moms about something. Now, when you receive something from the government and from the hospital to the whole ban the bags issue, there is an implied endorsement that this is good for me. It's been given to me by this health center that I've been coming to for all these years, or this hospital where I delivered my baby. And so there is an implied endorsement. And so we see that the marketing of infant formula has been very aggressive in low-income communities, particularly through WIC. Now, WIC also, particularly in Philadelphia, has some great peer counselor programs. They're doing great things to really encourage moms to breastfeed. But nationwide, we know that WIC is an issue, particularly in low-income communities. Also wanted just to say to that community that we have to think of the hierarchy of needs, right? So again, I mentioned that we haven't properly showed women how to do in the context of their lives. And when a woman may have economic pressures, when she may be concerned about her education, her job prospects, other things, her hierarchy of needs dictate that breastfeeding may be very low on the totem pole. And so what we realizes that breastfeeding does not happen in a vacuum, and that, you know, other social stressors greatly impact a woman's ability to breastfeed successfully. And so these are some of the more complex issues we see in low-income communities.
Let me go back. Let me just jump and I'll get back to you in just a second, Kimberly, but let me go to you, Esther Chung. We haven't really talked about the health benefits of breastfeeding, and I want to make sure our listeners understand that.
So with the health benefits of breastfeeding, many are familiar with the fact that there's going to be fewer ear infections, less diarrheal illness, but I think what people also don't recognize is that there's evidence that there's a lower risk of leukemia, a lower risk of childhood obesity and adult obesity, and allergic disease, and asthma is a very common problem that we see.
You want to add to that, and just, I guess, the benefits for the baby, but also for the mother as well.
As well. One of the more recent benefits for babies that has been looked at is the SIDS too, sudden infantile death syndrome. So that was huge when that came out, that we encouraged moms more to breastfeed just because of that one safety issue. But a very large study came out last year that showed that women themselves are benefited by breastfeeding, with lower rates of high blood pressure, heart disease, ovarian cancer, breast cancer, adult obesity. Wow. So many reasons that the mom herself would be in better condition if she were to breastfeed her baby an optimal time period, which we actually at 1 year.
1 year.
Yeah.
Okay. Pediatrics, American Academy of Pediatrics, 6 months. You're saying a year. We're almost up in a break. Go ahead, Esther.
I also think that there's something very rewarding, having been a mother who breastfed two children, of really feeling like this is something that you're doing for your baby, and to watch your baby grow and thrive, you really have a lot of self-confidence and self-esteem about how capable you are as a mother if you're successful at breastfeeding. So I think it can be very rewarding.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Esther Chung, a professor of pediatrics at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. And Nemours, also with us, Deborah Sandrock. She's an attending physician at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, a board-certified lactation consultant. And from the NPR studio in New York, Kimberly Seals-Allers, a journalist and a breastfeeding advocate, founder of MochaManual.com. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
Hi, I'm Stephen Quinn. Cold Specs earned raves when she broke out in 2012 for her sparse, dark, soulful sound. Well, now she's back with a charged new record called Neuroplasticity, and Cold Specs performs live from it coming up on Cue the Summer. from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Move over, Willie Nelson. There is a new artist trying to make it in Nashville, 10-year-old Emmy Sunshine.
Who sang Sweet Lily, your silver queen is I.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We're talking about a trend called Ban the Bag. August is National Breastfeeding Awareness Month, and six hospitals in Philadelphia decided recently they would no longer send new moms home with infant formula as a way to encourage and increase breastfeeding. Talking with Deborah Sandruck, Esther Chung, and Kimberly Seals Allers, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Kimberly, tell us about the work that you're doing at Strawberry Mansion. That's a neighborhood here in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Well, we went to Strawberry Mansion. I'm working with Common Market, which is a food distribution company who's really committed to healthful lives in the city of Philadelphia. And we were really struggling with this question about how do we really figure out, one, how do people feed themselves better and how they feed their babies? What are the influences? So it's one thing for us to tell women a message about breastfeeding, but how do we actually motivate them? Who are the key influencers in their community, in their lives, et cetera, et cetera? And so we went to Strawberry Mansion to do a pilot project, which was supported by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, to talk about, to really try to learn about community influences, personal influences, and what helps people and influences them in terms of how they feed their babies and how they feed themselves, and what could be the possible connections. One thing that my previous work in other cities has shown me is that even when a mother has a good breastfeeding experience, if she goes home into a community that's a desert of support, and that's where the majority of her breastfeeding journey occurs, she's really in a setup for failure. And so it's been great that we have a lot of attention focused to hospitals, but communities are really the next frontier in really creating environments for mothers to succeed. And so in Strawberry Mansion, we were really doing community assessments. We were surveying residents to really get their ideas on different issues. One of the things that's been key to our project is that we look at good nutrition with a life course perspective. So good nutrition starts at birth. And we start with the first food, which is the best first food is breast milk. And then how do we kind of continue that idea, that can, you know, create a life continuum around nutrition, not look at breastfeeding in a silo in its own, but say, listen, we want to eat well from birth, and that includes breast milk as the first food, and then continuing with other healthful foods as you grow. So it was really enlightening to be in the community and learn from the residents. So much activity, so much pride in Strawberry Mansion the residents have about their history and their community, and really talking to them about their real barriers they're facing around eating well for themselves and breastfeeding their babies.
And I want to pick up on several things that you said, but going back to you, Esther Chung, it sounds like the importance of either role models in some, whether it's a mom or a grandmom or an aunt or, you know, a beloved neighbor that can talk to young people about the importance, the value, even the fun of breastfeeding.
Absolutely. And I think that there are well-intended relatives who just want to make sure that the new mother is getting enough rest. And so, you know, compassionately we'll say, here, why don't you just give the baby a bottle, or why don't you just pump, not necessarily understanding how challenging it could be to kind of get things coordinated in the first couple of weeks.
And the first couple of weeks. Go ahead, Kimberly.
No, I just want to say, to add to Professor Chung's point, this invisibility of breastfeeding is so severe, because one thing that we noticed in Strawberry Mansion was that when people don't see something, they don't even know how it occurs, right? So, you know, you have a lot of theories about breastfeeding that, you know, that they may have to fully expose their breasts or things like that. But these are things that they've never seen. So they don't even know what breastfeeding looks like. And so when you try to tell a mom that, listen, you could be sitting next to a nurse nursing mother not even know it. It could happen very discreetly, mm-hmm. but because of the media and their perception, there's a whole idea in their head about what breastfeeding looks like. And so when we think about the lack of role models and lack of invisibility, the invisibility of breastfeeding, it's very critical, because if you don't see anyone who looks like you doing something, then you're going to assume that people who look like you don't do it. And then you have no idea what it does actually look and feel like. And so we really wanted to create a visibility around breastfeeding. The other thing I just wanted to say briefly, when we think about role models, I always say that in the mainstream white community, we've had several celebrities, Angelina Jolie, Gisele Bündchen, really great women who have supported breastfeeding. Recently, Olivia Wilde, I believe her name is.
That's right.
You know, who have made it like a cachet and a beautiful thing to do that gets you in popular glossy magazines. And by and large, you know, black women and other women of color have not had those same level of role models in the celebrity world. And we know, whether we want to like it or not, that these things can be very influential on our popular culture. So again, it perpetuates the idea that women who look like me don't do this. And I will say that Beyonce breastfeeds.
I was going to say, we all just whisper Beyonce, too. I mean, no one looks
yes,
like Beyonce.
And that was one.
But nonetheless.
That was the one of the many that I was able to mention. I'm sure I have a much longer list.
Yeah.
I didn't mention Jennifer Garner and, you know, Pink and
right.
Gwen Stefani. So I'm saying that in comparison, the message is that there aren't women who look like me who I may admire or see in magazines who breastfeed.
Well, and picking up on that. And picking up on that and going to you, Deborah, which is that it's now possible. I remember doing shows years ago where it was a big deal for a woman to, or even illegal for a woman to breastfeed in public. In most states, as I understand it, it's perfectly legal to do it. I mean, does that help to sort of spread the message and perhaps even spread the image that it's okay to do this?
It is beginning to happen, you know, now that people are a little bit more comfortable and aware that lots of people are now starting to breastfeed. It's interesting in my office when there are moms waiting in the waiting area and they decide to start breastfeeding. We have some patients who will look over at them and say, why? And even my front staff will come out and say, guess what? Someone's breastfeeding out here. Isn't it wonderful? So it's still a wow, you know, and instead of being a more commonplace, which is what we hope for it to be in the future.
Is there a place? It sounds like you want to say something, Esther Chung.
I think it also has to do with messaging. Now that we've had these six hospitals come together, I've noticed a difference on our unit, postpartum, where we have signs that support breastfeeding. We've pretty much shut down our central nursery, and now we're doing rooming in. So I think that constant positive feedback and messaging is very helpful for women to feel like it's okay for them to be breastfeeding in waiting areas and public places.
There are women, whether whether they just don't know how to do it or not, but have trouble breastfeeding. It's not a pleasant experience, and I think some can feel guilty that they're not doing what they, you know, we are all saying is really the best for the child. How do we deal with that?
I think that's very true, and I even find healthcare professionals are a little bit hesitant to even talk about breastfeeding because they don't want to pressure women or make them feel guilty. The way I approach it is we talk to families and we say, what is it that you want to do, and we are here to support you, and how can we do that best? We know that the American Academy of Pediatrics wants babies to come back to the doctor's offices 2 to 3 days after going home, and that really helps because then they don't have to worry so much about whether or not their baby's losing too much weight and whether or not they're doing the right thing with breastfeeding.
Is that the worry that the child isn't getting enough to eat?
Absolutely. Like the invisibility that Kimberly mentioned was, it's so real. Women just are very insecure about whether or not their baby is getting enough. And I always say to families, let us get the gray hairs and do the worrying, and you just work on the breastfeeding.
In fact, we got an email from Nick saying, my wife didn't produce milk after our son was born last year, so we had to use formula. In her own mind, she was a bad mom because she was unable to breastfeed, suffered from postpartum depression, and that was not helped by strangers telling her that she should be breastfeeding. That's sort of the other side of what we've been talking about, Deborah, Sandra.
Right. And you do see that, unfortunately, because I think a lot of people put a big pressure upon themselves, especially the more people who are in the workforce and out there, and they're being expected to breastfeed. And it can be very challenging. So we try it, like Esther said, we really do try to be very helpful to them. And if breastfeeding is not working, not to say, okay, there's another way to do this. You can go ahead and just give formula. It's more of like, let's work this together, and whatever we can do, we'll get there.
Kimberly, yes. You talk a bit about the workforce, and it should be said that the work-family policies in the United States are not particularly generous. Women get 12 weeks of unpaid maternity leave, unpaid, I should underscore there, which makes it hard. I mean, if the goal is to breastfeed for 6 to maybe 12 months, and someone's going back to work at, let's say, 2 months, it's pretty hard to meet that criteria. Can you speak to that?
Well, yes. I mean, we know that our federal policies, I mean, I think, you know, the United States is the only OECD country that does not have a federal maternity leave. It's very embarrassing. And so we know that this is a huge barrier for moms, because in many places, people are returning to work in 2 weeks after delivery, mm-hmm. Or school, right? So we know that this is a huge barrier for mothers, and we know, I mean, we think about our system, right? It's perfectly okay for me to pay somebody else to take care of my children, but I can't be paid for taking care of my children. Something's not right there. So we know that, you know, this creates a huge barrier, because women say there's no point in starting when I have to stop in 2 weeks. So what we really have been seeing, and even with the Affordable Care Act, new policies in place that require employers to provide, you know, pumping breaks for moms, to provide a place for them to pump that cannot be a bathroom, to provide them with what they need to store their milk. And so we really have to begin to make employers more breastfeeding friendly, because this is a big barrier. Mm-hmm. I also just wanted to speak briefly to the pressure thing, because it is very unfortunate when mothers feel pressure. One of the things that I say to moms about the guilt is, I let them know, guilt, unfortunately, it comes with motherhood. It has nothing to do with breastfeeding, right? I breastfed both of my children.
And you're getting some knowing nods from some moms,
yes,
down here.
And this is very true. We have to have a real conversation. I mean, part of the problem is that we've made breastfeeding to be something that happens in meadows and people wear flowing dresses, and that's just not the reality. So when that doesn't occur for women in that way, they think they failed, something's wrong with them. So we have to begin to have real conversations. As was already said, those first 2 weeks, I say it's like joining a sorority. You know, it may be a real challenge during that time, but you can really get through it. But I always like to tell moms, listen, I breastfed both of my children for more than 12 months, and then I went back to work and still felt guilty. You know, I have a 14-year-old now, and I feel guilty about a whole lots of things. So mommy guilt is unfortunately par for the course in mothering these days, some degree of it. But we don't want mothers to feel guilty about, you know, not being able to feed their babies. But I think the guilt is more of a symptom of a disappointment at the structural barriers, a disappointment that we really aren't able to do what we want to do, which is most of us be home and take care of our babies. But, you know, increasing economic demands, we talked about the family leave policies that need much improvement. These things make us frustrated. And we know that stress can impact the biological and physiological response of lactation. And so, you know, now we're a bunch of stressed out moms who aren't able to produce milk the way we would like to, and that leads to more frustration, and it's a snowball effect, and it's not good for women.
And that's Kimberly Seals Aller. She's a journalist, a breastfeeding advocate. She's working on an initiative in the Strawberry Mansion neighborhood of Philadelphia, founder of MochaManual.com. Deborah Sandruck, an attending physician at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. She's also a board-certified lactation consultant. And Esther Chung is a professor of pediatrics at Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. And Nemours, also the medical director of the newborn nursery at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. Those St. Christopher's and Thomas Jefferson are both here in Philadelphia. Very credentialed three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we talk about the value of breastfeeding and some of the barriers as well. Let me get Rachel from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I am a mother of a 3.5-month-old baby, and I'm exclusively breastfeeding. I'm of the demographic that is breastfeeding at relatively high rates, highly educated, white, middle-class woman. And I found it really challenging in ways that when I think about women that are coming into this with more structural barriers, it's a huge issue. But I wish that somebody had told me that it would be so hard. You know, I feel like the narrative is that it's natural and it's something that women have always been able to do. And you know, I found out that for the first 2 months of my baby's life, I was spending 7 hours a day breastfeeding, and it was hurting a lot of the time, and you have to buy special clothes that work with breastfeeding and pumping, and, you know, it changes your body, and there are all of these things happening that I think, you know, I read about it beforehand, and I took a birthing class where they talked about breastfeeding, and I still feel like I didn't really get a picture of this, that even as somebody who was very committed and didn't, you know, everybody in my social circle was supportive and all of those things that we want to see in place, it was still really challenging. So both sure. for women coming into it the way that I did, and then especially for women that are dealing with much less flexible work schedules and who don't have family to help and who don't have friends who are also breastfeeding, I can't imagine, you know, it's no wonder that women aren't continuing to breastfeed with all of these things in place, along with pain and the amount of time and all of the things that need to be in place with that. But I feel knowing that it would have been this hard would have been nice going into it.
You raised some good points. Let me tell us that first to Esther Chung. Go ahead, Esther.
I couldn't have said it better, so thank you very much. I usually don't like to use sports analogies, so if my husband's listening, I hope he's not too embarrassed. But I think that breastfeeding in the first couple of weeks of life is like being in spring training. It is difficult, and I use those words with families. We would love it if we could have obstetrics and gynecologists say more during pregnancy so that women are prepared for the adventure that they're entering. It's overwhelming to be a new mother or a new parent, but breastfeeding the first couple weeks is like being in spring training, and you know, like the Nike commercial says, no pain, no gain. So,
And those midnight feedings or those 3 a.m. feedings, too, on top of that, Deborah Sandra.
Right. So, I echo your words every day with my families when I speak to them in Philadelphia, and I tell them that, you know what, the most successful moms are the moms that walk in that door, and when I ask them, how is breastfeeding going, how often are you breastfeeding, and when they say, all the time, it's exhausting, I say, you're doing a great job, and welcome to our world, this is what we do when we breastfeed, and unfortunately, it's very difficult, and what we try to do in our practice is to really provide them that kind of support so that they recognize that it's hard, it's a hard journey, and, you know, their bodies do change, and what ends up happening is that they want to go back into their normal lifestyles, and they can't continue the breastfeeding because of that.
But does it make sense under those conditions to supplement breastfeeding with a bottle here and there?
I actually say that, you know, physiologically, women are making enough colostrum to support their babies, and if they can get through the first couple of weeks, it is a very easy process to breastfeed. So as difficult as it seems in those first couple of days, it's actually quite easy. So by the end of the first month, women are talking on the phone, breastfeeding, and writing their thank you cards all at the same time.
Kimberly, did you want to add something? Go ahead.
I did, and I just wanted to say one of the things that has been such a great comment, and I love what everyone's saying on the panel, and one of the things also when I talk to moms, because we do have this conversation about breastfeeding is hard, which goes back to we have to stop these unrealistic messaging and visual images about breastfeeding, and social media has done a great job at really allowing women to show the realities of breastfeeding, posting pictures so that people understand it's not always beautiful and like the magazines like to portray it, but I think also that when we talk to women about something being difficult, what I talk to them about is the things that, you know, life is hard, right? So I can share with them things that were very difficult for me, whether it was being the only woman of color at Fortune magazine for many years or getting through college, but that was worth it. You know, so this idea that we won from hard is not who we are as women. So yes, it is hard, but try to help them. I always try to help mothers think about all the other things that they may have, you know, kind of challenged through, got themselves through, and got to the other side, because really, parenting is hard, right? And I always say, I have a 14-year-old now, and I'll go back to breastfeeding any day. So again, we don't want to give women an unrealistic view of motherhood as well, including breastfeeding, but I think we also need to help them draw strength from the accomplishments that they've had. There have been many other things that have been hard in your life, I'm sure, that you've got through because you saw the benefit. And that's the message we want to give to mothers, that you're absolutely sure. Right. It's not easy.
And that was a joke, right? You're not going to breastfeed your 14-year-old.
No. I mean, to go back to the challenges of those rather than dealing with a teenager.
We just wanted to check on that. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about the values and some of the impediments to breastfeeding. We'll be right back.
The Dell Music Center proudly supports WHYY and presents jazz artists Al Jarreau and David Sanborn in a double bill concert at the newly renovated Dell Music Center in Fairmount Park. Two of America's noted jazz players, with more than a dozen Grammy Awards between them, will collaborate on Thursday, August 21st at 8 p.m. Concert parking is available. Information at mydelleast.com. The Dell Music Center, where the stars take center stage. The Dell Music Center proudly supports WHYY.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Telling sexual assault victims, it's not your fault.
People carry around a ton of blame and guilt and shame for things that were done to them, and it's really victimizing that person twice.
Creating a shared space for victims of sexual assault and harassment, that's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that babies be breastfed for the first 6 months of their lives. Our guests here in our Philadelphia studios say go for 12. Most parents, though, stop before 3 months or around that time, and we are talking about the benefits and barriers to breastfeeding with Deborah Sandrick. She's a lactation specialist, attending physician at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. Esther Chung, a pediatrician at Thomas Jefferson University, director of their newborn nursery, and Kimberly Seals-Allers, a journalist, a breastfeeding advocate for low-income moms. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As someone who breastfed my baby, let me also just say that breastfeeding is wonderful. I don't want people listening to go away with the impression that it's hard work and painful. Yes, there's part of that, but it seems to me once you get over some of that, I'm looking at you, Sandra. There's something magical about it.
There is, and I have the benefit of being able to see moms very early on at 4 and 5 days of age when the baby's just coming to my office and the mom's breasts are full of milk, and just to see the joy on the mother's face when the baby latches on for the first time and you hear the swallowing and mom says, oh my goodness, I'm doing that, I'm going to be able to feed my baby, and then you follow them week after week and watch the baby grow. It's a wonderful thing, a wonderful experience.
And doesn't cost a penny. Right.
I just saw a baby this week who came to me feeding half formula and half breast milk, and I said, you just have to trust that your body is going to make enough milk. And 2 weeks later, the baby is thriving on exclusive breastfeeding, and this is a family that doesn't have a lot of support, so right. We were really excited to see that.
Let me get Catherine from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
thanks for having me.
Sure.
I appreciate everything everyone is talking about, and despite my own troubles, I still think you all are just wonderful in supporting this in the community. But unfortunately, physiologically, I'm not capable of breastfeeding. I've seen breast surgeons and endocrinologists, and I've stumped them all. And as a mother who, you know, is in this very small niche, of not being able to produce at all, not just a low quantity, but I actually can't produce. I had trouble finding support and information in the breastfeeding community. And, you know, it was very isolating. And, you know, I was just looking for information that we could put out there for people who, you know, face this. And if
sure.
there's any conversations in the community.
Catherine, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Deborah.
So the International Lactation Consultants Association is a big organization. It's international, and certainly there are support systems in that group where myself as a board-certified lactation consultant can send you to someone who will be able to support you. And sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have your baby at your breast to feed them. There are supplemental nurser systems and things that really are modified breastfeeding. So for moms who really want to breastfeed, there is a way. So you know, look into that on your on the website. You'll be able to find someone who can help you.
Catherine, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kimberly, I have an email for you from Holly. What rights do breastfeeding mothers have if it's challenging to get reasonable work accommodations? Can you answer that?
Yes. So basically the rights that you have through the Affordable Care Act is that your employer, and there is a, I believe it's for employees who have more than 50 employees, they do have a right to, a woman has a right to take pumping breaks. And those breaks would have to be that she would be allowed to go and express her milk. The employer must provide a place that is clean. It cannot be a bathroom. And she has to have a place, a plug, and a place to store her milk. You know, the trick with the law is certainly enforcement. And we've seen a number of cases in media where women have sued their employers and won for the employer's failure to accommodate mothers. So we see a whole new area of law coming up around this lactation discrimination and things like that. But, you know, we don't want mothers to have to turn into union activists at work. You know, that's not everybody's personality, and it's very tragic that women would have to go through these measures just to feed their baby, you know, the most nutritious food and the way that they choose to feed their babies. But you can certainly go to the USBC website, the United States Breastfeeding Coalition. Their website has a lot of great information. There are some state-by-state laws that can also let you know about your rights. So I know that the USBC website has all of that there.
Anything you want to add to that, Esther Chung?
I recently gave testimony at City Hall where City Council's considering a bill to support women in the workplace, and it passed through committee. I think that some of it's also more immediate for some women. They might say to me, you know, you don't understand who my employer is. So I think some women are actually very intimidated to even take on that fight in spite of having a federal law. But states and cities are making a lot of efforts to, you know, help the women who aren't covered by the ACA in Section 4207.
Let me get Kathy from Winfield to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a African-American female whose children are now beyond college age, but I remember my days of breastfeeding fondly, and I faced my largest adversity right within my family. My dad, who was old-fashioned, in many ways, just seemed disapproving. I guess the modern world had caught up with him, and I don't know what it was, but I enjoyed breastfeeding. I moved mountains to breastfeed my children, and I had three little boys in 3.5 years, and so I never seemed to stop breastfeeding until I got pregnant with the second one after the first one was only 4 months old. And so I had to stop then, but I wrote Oprah at the time because she was just coming on the air, and her shows were really popular, and I just thought this was such a crucial issue to discuss, and I got back one of these postcards and said, you know, your comments are well taken and we'll consider this for a future show, but I never saw one.
Oh, interesting.
But I understand how crucial this issue still is after 25 years because my girlfriend, who was also had a young child at a breastfeeding age, wouldn't do it because of the stigma. And so she would sit and watch me and didn't know how I could do it, and I would watch her and didn't understand why she couldn't do it. And, you know, but we loved each other and we didn't judge each other, but I moved mountains to breastfeed my children.
Well, Kathy, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think some inspirational words. Yeah, go ahead, Kimberly.
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, Kathy, congratulations for moving mountains for your children, right? That's just what we do as mothers, and for you to start your journey with such an empowering experience, I'm sure shaped the rest of it. And I want to speak to just how critical that is. I mean, a lot of the work that I do is really based on infant mortality reduction efforts, right? Particularly in Philadelphia, where the infant mortality rate for black infants is very high, more than double that of white infants. So what we know is that breastfeeding, particularly in the African-American community, saves lives because far too many babies are born too small, too sick, or too soon. And for them, breast milk is literally almost life-saving. And so what we're talking about in this country is often a lifestyle or a choice conversation. But please be clear that particularly for African-American women, women and babies, it is really a life-saving measure. And we look at the things, SIDS was mentioned, particularly high in African-American community, obesity, diabetes. So this is a real health imperative for black infants. And for some of them, it could mean their very lives. And so it's not a conversation about choice and, you know, what we can do and lifestyle. It really is a real health imperative for many in the African-American community.
Do you see it that way, Deborah?
I do. And, you know, it's so nice that you bring up the issue of the premature infant, because there's something very special about breast milk, is that it comes the perfect amount, type of milk for the stage of the baby. So you have a premature infant, premature milk is perfect for that baby. They may need to have supplement, but when you look at infant formula, it's actually formulated at 3 months of age of what a breastfed baby would be. So that milk that you're looking at in formula is looking at 3 months age breast milk for infants. So newborn breast milk is much, much different than that. I talk to my families about the biofilm that is created from mom's immune system to just kind of create a barrier to infection, and just such a wonderful opportunity that we have if we can encourage moms to continue their breastfeeding longer.
We have an email from Kathleen. She wants to know, is it safe for moms to breastfeed while on an antidepressant such as Zoloft? Can you answer that, Esther Chung?
I think that's a terrific question. We feel that most antidepressants are safe with breastfeeding. There are some that would not be recommended in a breastfeeding mother. There are great resources available to anybody. There's something called LactMed, which
LactMed,
is a free app on Apple, and that's basically where you can enter any medication by trade name or generic name and find out what the effects are. But the large majority of medications are safe with breastfeeding, and if there are any questions, we would recommend that you speak to experts in breastfeeding.
Just to follow up on something that was mentioned earlier, let's say someone breastfeeds for a couple of weeks. Do they get some of the benefit?
Absolutely. We think that any breastfeeding is better than no breastfeeding, and so for the women who aren't able to sustain it, we feel like they've done a great job at getting their baby off to a great start.
Let me get Sarah from Washington Township to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to mention a really great community resource that I have in my community. My son is now 12 months old, and we're still breastfeeding. And our hospital has a lactation support group. And they have meetings twice a week that women are able to go to who are breastfeeding. It doesn't cost anything. And so for 2 hours twice a week, there's a whole community of women who are going through exactly the same issues that you are. And that was very helpful for me, both in terms of, you know, providing different kinds of role models for breastfeeding, getting help with how to breastfeed, and also just with connecting moms across a huge demographic range, because in that group we had sort of unwed teenage mothers, and then there were people like me who are academics with PhDs, and it was great on all those levels.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times to our lactation specialist, who's grinning ear to ear. Deborah, go ahead.
Oh, we look so forward to the time when we can have peer groups, support groups in the Philadelphia area. We have some activity going on within the WIC office, as we heard from Kimberly Ayers. We have it in some of our offices, and I can see Esther shaking her head, say, yes, we're doing it. And we're looking forward to it at St. Christopher's, just getting a group of moms together. Just, it's hard, though, in the city to get a group of women to find a place and to get there when they have to take 2 and 3 buses just to get to one site. So we're looking for more something in their community and how to do that. I would be open to anyone's suggestion how to do that.
How to make that easier to do. To you, Esther Chung, is there a time to wean a child that is the right time, healthy for both the child and for the mom?
I like the American Academy of Pediatrics statement, which is women should breastfeed their children for as long as it's mutually agreeable for the mother and the baby. So this is really an individual choice. With the AAP supporting breastfeeding for the first 12 months of life, I've met women who are still breastfeeding at 5 years, and I think we just have to accept that there are going to be differences. For the women who want to go back to work and are ready to wean, you know, it's probably better not to go cold turkey and maybe just to do some gentle weaning, but it really is going to be on an individual basis.
Let me get Ellen from Horsham to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
One of the previous callers just mentioned about support groups, and earlier in the conversation you talked about women who don't find support either in their family or among their friends having more difficulty. Something that I personally found really helpful was attending support groups before my baby was born, and then you have that built-in support with the community. And I found that through La Leche League, but there are other places that people can go to find that kind of support. La Leche League is an international organization and available in many communities. There's also online forums for people who maybe live in a rural area and aren't able to get to a meeting, or an urban area where something might not be as close by for them. And I just wanted to address one other thing that was mentioned about the Affordable... about the Affordable Care Act. It is accurate what was mentioned, but it applies more to salaried workers than, or excuse me, to hourly workers than salaried workers. So that's just something, again, to have a conversation with your employer before you have your baby about your intentions for when you return to work, to make sure that everyone is on the same page.
Fair enough. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kimberly, I can't get too deep into the Affordable Care Act and nursing at work, but anything you want to add based on what Ellen just said?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, they're trying to make accommodations for people who may not work in offices, for those people who may, you know, work hourly wages at Starbucks or a coffee shop or things like that. And so it is a very complicated, and certainly it's only just a small step, you know, toward what we really want from others. Also, I just wanted to say that, you know, to just agree that breastfeeding support groups are just phenomenal. I tell everyone that I would not have been successful without one at my hospital, where I lived in New York. And, you know, they're really great. And they were great because I could get to them, right? I had a car and I had a job that allowed me to take a year off so I could attend the breastfeeding support groups, which were like 11 o'clock in the daytime. So again, we really have to think about how these, how support is accessible. And we, you know, I loved what that Deborah mentioned, how do we get this in the community? That's really our focus with the projects I've been working on with the Kellogg Foundation, is how do we get this micro level support? You know, one of the things that we always say about food is that people shouldn't have to travel far to get a fresh fruit or vegetable, right? And so we want to have the same model for mothers, micro local, easily accessible. People don't have to travel great distances to get there. We had a fascinating conversation with SEPTA, which was really, really supportive, because in Strawberry Mansion, people rely on public transportation.
Sure.
And of course, if you're going to be on the bus for 30 minutes, an hour to get to where you need to go, you might need to nurse. And so really great conversations with SEPTA around, you know, making sure that bus drivers are aware that nursing mothers are allowed, asking about their policies. But we really have to really have a deeper down dive conversation about what support looks like and how everyone can access it.
Well, on that note, we do have to end our conversation. Kimberly Seals-Allers, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having
me. You're very welcome. Deborah Sandrock, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Esther Chung, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Ariel Plotnick, our intern this summer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.